fasten your seatbelt, turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and this is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. Next Monday, December 7th, is Pearl Harbor Day, the day that marked the entrance of America into World War II, the day the Japanese bombed the U.S. fleet at our naval base in Hawaii. It was a surprise attack that lasted 2 hours and 2 minutes and resulted in the deaths of more than 2,400 servicemen and civilians and the destruction of 188 U.S. planes and 8 battleships. It was, as President Franklin Roosevelt said, a day that will live in infamy. Our guest today is Antigo native James Bradley. He has written 3 groundbreaking books about the U.S. war against Japan in the Pacific, and his new book, The Imperial Cruise, is already the most controversial. In it, he argues that another President Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, lit the fuse that led to World War II through a flawed and mistaken foreign policy that was a direct result of Teddy Roosevelt's world view, a view that Bradley argues was based in part on Teddy Roosevelt's racism. It was a view that white Christians alone should rule the world and that the Japanese would act as our proxies in securing American dominance in Asia. James Bradley's father, John, was one of the heroic figures in the iconic photo of Americans raising the flag at Iwo Jima. Bradley's first book, Flags of Our Fathers, was written about that event and made into a hit movie directed by Clint Eastwood. Now, the New York Times writes, quote, in Flags of Our Fathers, Bradley wrote about how his father helped plant the American flag on Iwo Jima. In The Imperial Cruise, he asks why American servicemen like his father had to be fighting in the Pacific at all. James Bradley is joining us today by telephone from Houston, Texas, where he is appearing at a meeting of the World Affairs Council. We also want to mention that Mr. Bradley will be appearing in Wausau at a book signing event for the YWCA. It takes place next Friday, December 11th, at the Palladian. That's downtown, right next to the Jefferson Street Inn. Now, as always, we want to hear from you. You can give us a call at 261-6371 if you're in the Wausau area. That's 261-6371, or toll-free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. James Bradley, are you with us?
Glenn, yes, I am.
You are talking to us via a cell phone. We had hoped to have a secure landline by now, but we understand that you were delayed in Houston by a special guest of yours.
Well, my second book, Flyboys, was about 8 guys who got killed on a tiny island in the Pacific. The guy that got away was named George Bush, and I was just meeting with former President Bush, the elder. And I apologize to your listeners that they're hearing me on this cell phone. At the second part of the interview, I'll be on a landline.
Well, we're happy that we're hearing you. What did former President Bush have to say?
Well, you know, I took him out to Japan and introduced him to some Japanese who were going to cut his head off at one time. And I've known him for years now. And we just had a little personal visit. He's doing very well, 85 years old. And we talked about my new book, The Imperial Cruise, which I have to say you summed up very well.
It's a controversial book, and I can't wait to delve into it with you. Besides speaking to former President Bush, what are you in Houston for?
The World Affairs Council. I'll be speaking there in an hour and a half. It's a great group of people who are interested in the world.
Well, we love the fact that you're taking some time and a substantial amount of time out of your day-to-day to be with us and our listeners on the Ideas Network. The Imperial Cruise has been out a few weeks now. How are people reacting?
Well, it's been out actually 1 week, and so it's brand new. And the New York Times, as you said, says that it offers a startling look at the Theodore Roosevelt presidency. In its first week, the New York Times only measured 4 days of sales because it came out on Tuesday, and it's breaking at number 9. So people are laughing it up, but if they bought it last week, you know, many haven't read it yet. So we're still waiting for response. It's being read in China and Korea and Japan.
And you deal with all of those countries in the book. Now, as I understand it, your thesis is controversial, that Teddy Roosevelt lit the fuse for World War II. Those are your own words. Explain to us exactly how you think that happened.
Well, I'd like to say that it's not a thesis. That if you look at the book, there's 40 pages of notes, and it's very difficult to come to any other conclusion. Pearl Harbor was not the invasion of the United States. Pearl Harbor was hit by the Japanese not to continue on to California. They had no intention of invading America. The Japanese hit Pearl Harbor so they could continue on with their game. What was the Japanese game? It was Japanese expansionism. It was expanding into Asia. My father did not leave Appleton, Wisconsin to go to Iwo Jima to protect his mother from the Japanese. The Japanese were not going to invade Appleton. What they wanted to do was invade Burma. And that's what World War II in the Pacific was about, Japanese expansionism. So I saw that if that was the problem, where did it begin? What was the source? What did America think at the first step of Japanese expansionism? And I found to my shock that it was in the summer of 1905 on this imperial cruise that I document in this book that President Theodore Roosevelt anointed this Japanese expansionism with a secret treaty that was unknown to Congress and unknown during his lifetime.
And of course, a secret treaty unknown to Congress is also unconstitutional.
Yeah, the Senate is supposed to look at foreign treaties. Roosevelt wrote that the Senate is not a good body for making treaties and that he would just go ahead and do it himself. But let's back up here. You know, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt looked at Pearl Harbor in 1941, he condemned it as a sneak attack. But hidden in history is the fact that this was the second Japanese sneak attack to start a war with a major Western power. The first was during the administration of Theodore Roosevelt when the Japanese hit the Russian Navy at Port Arthur. The Russians condemned it as a sneak attack. Theodore Roosevelt looked at it and wrote secretly, "I was thoroughly well pleased with the Japanese victory because the Japs are playing our game."
What was that game?
Yeah, this is the key. What game is Roosevelt talking about here, and what game is he playing secretly with the Japanese? The game was this. Roosevelt wanted to expand in North Asia. America couldn't expand in Africa or India. That was all taken. But North Asia, the area north of China where Russia, the Russian Empire comes in, Korea, that area was up for grabs. And Roosevelt felt that it was important for the future of America to put America's big stick in North Asia. He was frustrated that Congress would not listen to him. Congress would not give him the funds and the troops that he needed to put America's big stick in North Asia. So he looked to the Japanese as a surrogate, as a placeholder in North Asia. Theodore Roosevelt said, "The Japanese are the most dashing fighters in the world." And he looked at Asia. Now, Glenn, I want to back up and say, I'm not, this could sound judgmental, and I don't mean it that way, because we've got to go back to 1905. Theodore Roosevelt, we were a Eurocentric country. Asia was the mysterious Orient. Few Americans had been to Asia. Roosevelt had met few Asians in his life, and he viewed Asia through theoretical lenses.
Those were racist lenses, as you document in your book.
Well, Glenn, you know, I never use the word racist because the word racist came into vogue in the 1930s. This is back in 1905, and there were racial theories, but they weren't. When we say the word racist, it's as if he made an individual personal choice. He went to Harvard and Columbia and his professors had racial theories to explain the to explain societies, and there were racial theories to explain who was up and who was down. He looked at Asia, and the theory was that China was collapsing like an old barn, and that the more potent, as he said, the more potent countries would take over North Asia. Well, the most potent Asian country was Japan, according to Roosevelt, because the Japanese were emulating American ways. He looked to the Japanese army to do what Congress would not let him do, and that is insert American interests into North Asia. So he agreed a secret treaty that allowed Japan to expand into Korea. There is no doubt that, you know, every divorce has a first kiss. World War II in the Pacific was about Japanese expansionism, and it was anointed and greenlit and approved in this summer of 1905 on this imperial cruise.
Who was on this imperial cruise?
It was led by Secretary of War William Howard Taft, Big Bill Taft, who was later president. He was Theodore Roosevelt's assistant president. He was Secretary of War at that time. And the mistress of the cruise was Theodore Roosevelt's daughter, Alice.
Now, she was quite a character, wasn't she?
Yes, she was called Princess Alice. If you said the word Alice in 1905, everyone knew who you were talking about, just like today we would say Britney or Cher. Alice was the Jackie Kennedy of her day. And this made the surprising thing to me, Glenn, was that when I looked at this, this made world headlines, this imperial cruise. Everybody knew about it. The whole nation of Japan basically stopped to welcome the Americans. It was a big, big deal back then, but it's been lost in the mists of time and overlaid by history.
Now, is it your theory that he put Alice on this cruise in order to keep the attention of a voracious press at the turn of the last century?
Definitely. He tried her out with some other presidential things. You know, now, today, we're used to presidential children representing the president, the Ford children and others, but Alice Roosevelt was the very first presidential child to represent a president overseas, and she did a dynamic job. The press could not get enough of her, which was very convenient for Roosevelt and Taft because it took attention away from their secret dealings.
James, I've got to take a quick break for an underwriter's announcement, but before I do that, I want you to give me a quick answer to this simple question. What were the hopes for this Imperial cruise when it embarked, and how did it change the world in the Pacific by the time it was over?
Simple answer. The Imperial cruise was a checkup on the Philippines, which was America's largest colony. It was our Vietnam or Afghanistan at the time. We had been there militarily for 7 years. And how it changed the history of the Pacific is that Theodore Roosevelt greenlit the events that would become Japanese expansionism. He greenlit the events that would sweep my dad out of Appleton, Wisconsin, out onto a tiny hill on an island that the Japanese called Iwo Jima.
James Bradley, his first book, Flags of Our Fathers, was written about his father, John, who raised the flag at Iwo Jima. His second was written about President George H.W. Bush. It was called Flyboys. James Bradley has just met with President Bush just a few minutes before we started our interview on the Ideas Network. And his new book, The Imperial Cruise, out for just a week, implicates Theodore Roosevelt in the events that led to World War II. 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to join the conversation, I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 on the Ideas Network.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
Our guest today, James Bradley, Antigo native, author of his third book on World War II, The Imperial Cruise. James, I'd like to delve a little bit into One of the most disturbing aspects, to me anyway, was your portrayal of Theodore Roosevelt, who viewed the world through a racial lens. Now you said you don't want to use the word racist, and I understand that these were different times back at the turn of the last century, but you document pretty clearly that Roosevelt believed that white Christians should rule the world and that they had the duty to dominate and even if need be kill people of supposedly inferior races in order to make that happen. Am I mischaracterizing things?
No, you're not, but I'd like to broaden it and say it wasn't that Roosevelt in the White House alone had these ideas. When I looked at the material, I saw that Roosevelt was explaining American involvement in the Philippines to the American public, and he had to use, you know, common ideas and ideas that all Americans share, just like President Obama had to the other night. And when he would talk to the American public, Theodore Roosevelt, he would say the Filipinos cannot have independence because they don't have the thousands of years of experience that we do in self-government. Well, I thought thousands of years. America's 100 years old at this time. Where's the thousands of years? Is he referring to Greece or Rome? And I looked at the books that he studied in Columbia and Harvard, and I realized that they were talking about racial theory. They were talking about the white race starting in the Caucasus and then moving west from Asia to Germany, where they became the Teuton, to England, where they became the Anglo-Saxon, across to the east coast of America and then to the west coast. And Roosevelt said, you cannot understand world history until you understand race history. He saw things through a racial lens. This was just a fact. So Roosevelt was talking to the American public in terms of these theories. So he wasn't alone. He wasn't some isolated racist. This is what we believed at the time.
It was the common view of most of the top intellectuals in the American in top American universities, political establishments. The guy you mentioned at Columbia University, John Burgess, is viewed as the father of political science. And once again, he referred to this a myth of an Anglo-Saxon Teutonic political genius which originated in the Black Forests of Germany, spread through England and North America. And he implied that only people with white blood should rule.
Well, you know, again, stronger than implied, the textbooks that Theodore Roosevelt read from at Columbia said explicitly that because the state is an invention of the white Teuton, only the white Teuton can be on top of the state. So Columbia University taught Theodore Roosevelt as a student that Asians cannot rule themselves. They are not white Teutons. They do not know how to handle statehood, and that the only way that Asia is going to get democracy and get advanced is if whites go there and take over. So the theory was that China was going to collapse and somebody had to take over, and Roosevelt thought he was doing a good thing for the future of America by wanting to jump into China, but Congress wouldn't fund the troops, so he used the Japanese army as a temporary surrogate.
Isn't this the same theory that led to the slaughter of the Indians, the invasion of Cuba, our eventual takeover of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and our invasion of the Philippines?
Yes. And
Roosevelt was there for all of that.
I went to a very nice school, University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I got a degree in East Asian history, and somehow I was able to get out of school without learning all of this. Glenn, I was shocked at what I found. I don't want your listeners to have the impression that I knew all this and I'm pointing fingers. I read what the top American officials were saying in 1905, and yes, they were explaining the world in terms of racial theory, series that everybody in America at their kitchen tables could understand at that time.
Well, it is well documented in your book, and it does explain an awful lot. It explains how we ended up in the Philippines. It explains how we justified what happened with the Indians. It explains the attack on Pearl Harbor, if indeed the Japanese were our proxies. And I'm wondering if it also explains Nazism and Hitler, if there's a view of an Aryan or a white Christian master race, how different is that from what Hitler believed in?
Well, you know, again, I leave off in 1905, and I've got to leave those connections to everyone else, but the book took me 6 years because I just went into a totally different time. And again, what surprised me is that I was able to get a degree and read books about Roosevelt in the 19th century, and I was never exposed to what they were actually thinking. This is hidden history. The New York Times asked why Roosevelt biographers have left all this information on the cutting room floor.
James Bradley, his new book is called The Imperial Cruise. It is a new look at Theodore Roosevelt, the policies of America at the turn of the last century, and how they may have led to the situation in Japan that led directly to Pearl Harbor and World War II, perhaps also to the Korean War, perhaps also, as we'll find out in the next half hour, to the Chinese Communist Revolution that took place after World War II. I'm Glenn Mulberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. James Bradley will be back with us after this short break for news. We want to hear from you, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UW Extension Division of Continuing Education, Outreach, and E-Learning, helping working professionals meet their continuing education and professional development goals. 1-866-505-UWIN.
I'm Glenn Mulberg. We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. Our guest today, James Bradley. His father, John, one of the heroic figures in the iconic photo of Americans raising the flag at Iwo Jima. His first book was about that subject, Flags of Our Fathers, turned into a hit movie. His second book, Flyboys, about George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, and his role in the war in the Pacific. And James Bradley has just met with President Bush about 45 minutes ago before we started this interview with him. The new book is even more controversial. It's called The Imperial Cruise, in which he documents the role Theodore Roosevelt played in the events that led up to World War II. 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. James, you've done a lot of interviews before the national media, but it's not often you get a chance to sit down for a full hour with the media from your own neck of the woods. And as you know, the Bradleys are very well known in central Wisconsin. Your brother Mark is the president of the UW Board of Regents. Your brother Patrick, a former president of the Rotary Club of Wausau, your sister-in-law, Ann Walsh Bradley, a state Supreme Court justice. So we thought it would be fun and a bit of a surprise to you to introduce you once again to a visitor who's joining us for just a couple of minutes here in our studio. James, if you'd like to say hi to your mom, Betty.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Mommy.
Hi, Jim.
Oh, good. You're there. I called you at home to tell you to listen.
Well, I've been here through and heard it all, and I'm really honored to be here and listening to you and Glenn Mulberg talk about your book, The Imperial Cruise. And it's unbelievable that that book got on the New York Times 10 bestseller list in only 4 days after it was available for sale. You're doing good, Jim.
Well, thank you, and I got to say something about Northern Wisconsin. This is the single best interview I've had in the whole week. Glenn's read the whole book; he knows it. The setup that I had, and I'm not just gilding the lily here, Glenn, but the setup on the book that you did at the top of the hour is the best I've had. Thank you. Well, my honor.
I did pick up the book, and I couldn't put it down. James, you often tell the story about how your dad didn't talk much about his experiences in World War II. Betty, I'm wondering, why was that? Why was that something that you didn't talk about around the dinner table in Antigo?
I think that if there was some fellows that he was on Iwo Jima with around the dining room table, they might talk about it, but to explain what happened there to somebody who has never been there, I think it's very difficult. And also, why not go ahead? Why go back and dwell on those things?
Well, every year at about this time, back when you were living in Antigo and John was still alive, you'd get calls from reporters wanting to talk to him right before Pearl Harbor Day. How did he react to that, and what did he instruct the family to do?
Well, he definitely avoided answering the phone around those anniversaries, and we were to say he was not available, and we sounded a little stupid because we'd act as if we didn't know where he was.
James, does that bring back memories?
Yeah, you know, I didn't. That's really why I wrote Flags of Our Fathers, is that I just wanted to find out why he didn't talk. I didn't set out to write a book. I just called the other people on Iwo Jima to find out why was he silent all those years. He was a corpsman on Iwo Jima, and he witnessed a massacre. He had a lot of reasons not to talk.
And it all started with a shoebox that you found up in the attic. Isn't that correct?
Well, it started with what my mother, in the movie they portray me finding a box, but my mother and my brothers Patrick and Mark were above my father's funeral home, and they found a number of papers, his will and whatever. And my mom sent me a Xerox of a letter that my father wrote home from Iwo Jima a couple days after the flag raising, in which he said the flag raising was the happiest moment. When I read that letter, wondering why my dad had never been able to share that happy moment with his family.
And that led to the research that led to your first book. Betty, did you ever think that Xerox copy of that letter would lead to a writing career?
No, I certainly did not. You know, Jim graduated from the University of Wisconsin with a major in East Asian history, and his father and I looked at each other and thought, what in the world will he ever do with that?
What do you think John would think about this book and the premise behind it, that Theodore Roosevelt's actions and a distorted worldview paved the way for his service in Iwo Jima?
Mm-hmm. I'm sure he knew nothing about that. Well, very few people did know the true history of Theodore Roosevelt. Had he known this?
Had he known it? If he could be around today and he read the book, what would he think of it?
Well, I think he'd be very proud of his son. I really do. And you see, it wouldn't bother him because he isn't here to get the attention. He didn't like the attention.
I'm doing an interview.
James?
Yep?
Will you have any time to be with your family this Christmas season?
I'll be there in December 11th. I'm speaking in Wausau. And then the next day I'm going over to the big city of Antigo to speak there. We just lined it up today, and we're going to have a family get together that weekend.
And again, if you'd like to see James Bradley, he is at a book signing reception and a fundraiser for the YWCA. It's this next Friday, December 11th, at the Palladian next to the Jefferson Street Inn in Wausau. You can find out more at 842-3381. Betty, we're going to let you go. Thanks for helping us pull this surprise on your son.
You're welcome, and see you soon, Jim.
Okay, see you, Mom.
James, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more about the Imperial Cruise and your phone calls, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at UMR.com. UMR.com.
Our guest today on Route 51, author James Bradley, his new book, The Imperial Cruise. If you'd like to join the conversation, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. James joining us from Houston, Texas, where he is about to make an appearance, and where just about 45 minutes ago he was speaking with the first president, George H.W. Bush. James, Teddy Roosevelt, as you document in your book, was pretty much the first public relations president we ever had.
He was. You know, we have to go back to the 1880s when he graduated from Harvard, and just the use of photographs was new. And he went west, and then he went west to collect stories out in the Dakotas. And he came back and went into photo studios and took pictures of him that resembled Buffalo Bill. Buffalo Bill was the most famous manly man of his time. And Roosevelt, Buffalo Bill was the hunter who went out there in the wilderness. And then Teddy became Ranchman Teddy, who followed the hunter. The ranchman, in the evolutionary scale of things, was the next scale up. And he wore the same clothes that Buffalo Bill did, and he became an expert on the West, but most of that expertise was honed in the Astor Library in downtown Manhattan.
Buffalo Bill's Wild West show was a big deal. It was three trains full of people. He had Annie Oakley touring with him. They had literally they had livestock, buffalo. They had all of these things, and it created this image we have of the Wild West. Theodore Roosevelt later called himself a rough rider, and you say in the book that he kind of borrowed that from Buffalo Bill.
Well, he 100% borrowed it. It was Buffalo Bill's Wild West and Rough Riders of the World, and then Theodore Roosevelt borrowed the name 100%. Buffalo Bill was a little concerned about it, but there was no trademark back then.
Roosevelt came from an aristocratic background. His family owned lots of land in New York. And he was elected to the state Senate in New York, and part of the book that kind of surprised me, when he showed up in Albany in his early 20s, he was actually ridiculed for being effeminate.
He was ridiculed for being effeminate. The politics was the purview of beer-drinking, cigar-smoking guys, and Roosevelt was an aristocrat with a high Harvard voice, and they laughed at him. And thought he was effeminate. He showed up his first speech. He wore a purple satin suit. And to remedy this image of being effeminate, he went west and emulated Buffalo Bill.
And those pictures that we see of him with the fringe jacket and the rifle of staring off in the distance, you say those were actually shot in a New York photo studio?
In a New York photo studio, yeah. Roosevelt is holding a rifle as if he's pointing the game, but without his glasses on, he couldn't see the end of the rifle. And, you know, again, I'm not trying to belittle or criticize Theodore Roosevelt. Look, I'm an author, and I put on a tie when I speak. I mean, I try to project a certain image. Roosevelt saw that the number one most famous guy in the world at that point was Buffalo Bill. Roosevelt wanted to be a famous author, so he wrote about the West, which was very romantic at that time, and he styled himself as a Westerner for the public.
How much riding around the West did he actually do at that period? Was he sleeping under the stars and going horseback riding and shooting bears and guarding the women folk against the savages on the high plains?
He was going west, but his ranches were investments. He had people running them. His going west was more like a rich Harvard kid going to Vail today and doing a lot of skiing and writing about it. He didn't actually live out there, contrary to the myth and contrary to what he later claimed. This was all a big surprise to me. I remember sitting at Bass Lake up there in Wisconsin in... It must have been the summer of 2006, and Time magazine did a July 4th special on Theodore Roosevelt with a cover of Roosevelt on the cover of Time, And they repeated all these myths that he spent all this time out west. And I was reading the actual facts that he didn't. But these are myths that we continue to repeat for some reason.
There's another man who's written a book about Teddy Roosevelt. He's a noted biographer, Douglas Brinkley. His book is called The Wilderness Warrior, Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America. I'm going to play just a short minute-long clip of Douglas Brinkley on the Today Show, or rather the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, back in August. And James, portrays a completely different picture of Theodore Roosevelt than the one you've been portraying. I'd like your reaction to it after we play this clip.
And Roosevelt used the federal government and put a string of pearls around Florida for bird reservations, saved Key West, Dry Tortugas. He went on and created 51 federal bird reservations, far-flung places like Alaska, Western Hawaiian Islands, and that gave birth to U.S. Fish and Wildlife and our national wildlife system.
He's the father of modern conservation, it would seem. How do people accomplish so much in that time? There was just a different ethic.
It was a different ethic, but he had a father who pushed him a lot. His father was the founder of the American Museum of Natural History,
right,
and a great dad. He would take young Theodore all over the world. He would took him to the Nile. In fact, as a young man, Theodore Roosevelt climbed the Matterhorn and got to the top and saw no wildlife and always wanted to make sure that our Rockies had animals and the Cascades and the Appalachians, on and on. And he just learned to live what he called the strenuous life. Part of it is that he was became a disciple of Charles Darwin, and this thought that death is looming at any moment, and you have to live your life to the fullest every day. And he did, and one of the things I write about here is how he, without him, we wouldn't have had what he called heirlooms, like the Grand Canyon or Crater Lake or Wind Cave, on and on and on. And he did it because he felt the wilderness made our city life better, that even if you don't leave New York or New Jersey.
There's no reason to point at me when you say that.
That's historian Douglas Brinkley, author of The Wilderness Warrior, Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America, with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show a couple of months ago. James, clearly a laudatory view of at least some of what Roosevelt did. How do you feel about his domestic agenda and his environmental agenda?
I think everything Brinkley said there is true. And, you know, this is the reason that we don't have one historian and there's not one version of history. History's more complicated. Roosevelt was a complicated guy. Everything that I write in my book is true, but I didn't set out to write a biography of Theodore Roosevelt. I set out to write about this imperial cruise, and what Brinkley is saying about the great conservationists, about the strenuous life, that's all true, but not in conflict with what I wrote, but what the things that I wrote are often not picked up by historians. And we've got to look at Roosevelt in a more multifaceted way.
When the Imperial cruise sailed into Canton, China, to get back to the central thesis of your book, William Howard Taft and the delegation were met with anti-American protests, anti-American signs. Explain to us why that was the case. Here they are on this major cruise touring Asia in order to expand America's influence, and they end up with this very hostile relationship against the largest nation in Asia.
Yeah, you know, I had no idea, but when they went into China, there was a boycott against everything American. Chinese would not buy anything made or produced in America. And the reason why is because we had exclusion laws against the Chinese. Again, the theory was that China was a declining race and we did not want Chinese to come to this country. Theodore Roosevelt signed the most draconian Chinese exclusion laws in history. The Chinese, with a 4,000-year civilization, felt insulted by Roosevelt's actions, and they cut off trade.
Roosevelt felt they were barbarians, and yet these people had, you know, they invented movable print 400 years before Gutenberg did.
Yeah, the Chinese, but again, you know, Roosevelt, it wasn't as if Roosevelt lived in Asia and had firsthand experience. He was dealing through the theories that he picked up in the Ivy League that were current on the East Coast of America that time. And if you wanted to be in the policy-making councils of the United States government, one thing you had to agree on is that China was a declining race, and you didn't even have to deal with them. Incredibly, when Theodore Roosevelt got the Japanese and the Russians together to negotiate the end of the Russo-Japanese War, they negotiated about who would get what Chinese territory, but Roosevelt never thought to bring the Chinese to the table because he was sure that China would have nothing to say about the future of Asia. Can you believe it?
Well, there was also incredible bigotry and discrimination against the Chinese who lived in America at the time. In fact, you write about a massacre at Rock Springs, Wyoming, in which the population basically slaughtered hundreds of Chinese people who had ended up there after they helped build the Intercontinental Railroad.
You know, if you look at it, if Westerns were made accurately, you'd have John Wayne walking down a street, going to a Chinese restaurant, sleeping in a Chinese hotel, and getting his clothes done in a Chinese laundry. The Chinese who built the railroads and who dug the gold had spread all over the West, and there were Chinatowns in almost every Western railroad town. But where did those Chinese go? They were chased out at the point of a gun. In Seattle, the mayor led a mob of people who surrounded the Chinatown and marched the Chinese to a waiting ship. All across the West, the Chinese were cleaned out in the 1870s and 1880s and no longer there.
Well, Teddy Roosevelt has one distinction that he shares with our current American president. They both won Nobel Peace Prizes. Which do you think was most controversial?
Well, Roosevelt's was not controversial at the time because the Nobel Peace Prize Committee never learned that Roosevelt negotiated this secret treaty with the Japanese. It was only, you know, that was a shocking thing in this book that the Nobel Peace Prize Committee never knew that as Roosevelt was posing as the honest broker between Japan and Russia, he was actually acting as a secret agent of Japan.
How do you think President Roosevelt, if we could suddenly transport him 100 years, 104 years after this imperial cruise to America, how would he react to America as it is today?
Well, you know, Glenn, I want to say I'm on a cell phone that might run out of battery. If I just go off, that's the reason why. But how Roosevelt would react today, I think he would be shocked that China is such a powerful country. I think he would be shocked that his secret treaty with Japan resulted in so many deaths in World War II in the Pacific. And then I think that he was a very, very intelligent and sensitive guy. I think if you gave him enough time, he'd come to and understand the realities of today.
What would Teddy Roosevelt say about not only today's America, but the fact that his office is now held by a black man who was serving as president?
That was beyond comprehension at that time. Again, not because he individually was a racist, but because racial theory, that was the theory taught in the Ivy League at top institutions, held that there was not the brain capacity in a black man or in a Chinese man to rule a state. Roosevelt would have a lot to learn by today's standards, but you know, I think if we go back to the 1950s, we don't have to go back to 1905 to think about Americans who could never imagine a black man being president.
And it appears that there's still a lot of Americans who can't imagine a black man as president.
Yeah, you know, we just Mark in the book, I have a quote from Mark Twain where he says that there are many humorous things in the world. One of the most humorous is that the white man thinks that other men are more savage than he. It's one world, and we better get with it.
James Bradley, thanks so much for joining us for the past hour. It's been fascinating. We want to thank James Bradley, whose new book is The Imperial Cruise, A Secret History of Empire and War, a reminder that Mr. Bradley will appear at a book signing reception and fundraiser for the YWCA next Friday, December 11th, at the Palladian next to the Jefferson Street Inn in Wausau. You can find out more information at 842-3381. I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks also to James Bradley's mom, Betty Bradley, who joined us briefly earlier this half hour. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producers, Jane Ritker and Lila Rausch, also our online producer, Scott Clark. Thanks as always to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. And a reminder that you can follow us and our adventures on both Facebook and Twitter. Next week, we look at the continuing effort to crack down on drunk driving in our area and the state of Wisconsin, with the state Senate scheduled to debate a bill that would toughen penalties for OWI offenders. Our guest next week, a spokesperson for the AWARE program, that's a statewide effort to toughen drunk driving laws, also Sue Nowak of Premier Recovery Services in Wausau, and Pete Wasson of the Daily Herald in Wausau, a newspaper that has made drunk driving one of its editorial priorities. Thanks for riding along with us today. Remember Pearl Harbor Day on Monday, and until next week, we are heading out of town.